This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
This email from Winter in Winchester. Dear Dogs Brown and Savage, it seems that the planets have aligned that we may be witness to a once-in-a-lifetime meltdown of legendary proportions, as this week's new releases include not one, not two, but three Kermode baiting movies. A new category.
Go on.
An American comedy about a group of immature men that includes the Good Doctor's favourite boxer stroke misogynist, Mike Tyson. A slick remake of The Last House on the Left and Doghouse, a zombie movie that not only casts women as monsters, but has the misfortune of featuring the acting skills of the dolphin-esque impression.
Hang on. Who's this an impression of? Who's that?
I have no
There we go,
idea.
See? The word you were looking for was Danny Dyer. And I know Danny Dyer doesn't do that, but there we go.
Half of me is looking forward to the fireworks, but the other half hopes I'm wrong, because I would like to go to the cinema this weekend. So all those things coming up. Kermode baiting movies. What a splendid idea. We'll see how we go on those.
Do you know what the musical instrument I'm learning to play at the moment is?
Oh, no. Does it involve lots of slapping?
No, because, you know, I'm getting old. So I have this thing, learn a new instrument every year to stop getting old.
A Jew's harp.
No. I did bagpipes last year. I'm learning the theremin, which is an instrument that was designed to be played by anybody, but it turns out it can be played by almost nobody.
Bill Bailey has a good go at that.
Yeah, he does, and a much better go at it than I do. I mean, when I do it, it does just sound like radio interference.
This is David Hardacre in Gloucester. Yeah. Oh, no, we'll come to his letter, because it's quite good. So let's do the box office top 10, and then we can
work zip through it.
Zip indeed. X-Men Origins, Wolverine's at 10.
Boring.
12 rounds at 9.
Didn't go, and actually, but if it's out by next week, I'll have an excuse for not going.
Hanam and Tanar, the movie, at 8.
Better than Jonas Brothers, the I can't do that. Better than Jonas Brothers.
Coraline at 7.
Good, intelligent, scary kids' fun, although I don't really get the 3D thing.
Last Chance Harvey at 6.
Didn't get a chance to do this last week because we ran out of time. And, you know, a very sort of... on one level, it's a kind of sub-Richard Curtis thing about Emma Thompson and Dustin Hoffman as two people at a certain point in their life. Dustin Hoffman, obviously, far more advanced in his life, both of whom seem to be on their last chance for happiness. They meet in London. She's working at an airport. He's coming from America to come and visit his daughter, who's getting married. And they have one of those, you know, like Before Sunrise or Before Sunset. They have 24 hours together. They wander around the South Bank, and they sort of discover that they may or may not have a connection. And I expected it to be quite hard work, but I liked it more than I thought, partly because, honestly, Emma Thompson reading the phone book, I would now pay to see. And it has one of those moments in it in which she does that thing that she does in Love Actually, which is a moment of quiet anguish. And I've decided that from now on, any film that requires a moment of quiet anguish, you need to just give that role to Emma Thompson, because regardless of what else is happening, she's just going to nail it so hard.
Star Trek at 5.
Great. Don't care what people say. Had a lot of abuse. People saying, you know, not a real Trek fan. No. Good film.
Angels and Demons at 4.
Rubbish. And I was Googling the other day, and I read something in, I think it was Russian or Afghanistan, some language which didn't involve the alphabet, which we're familiar with, except I recognised my name and then opening quotation marks and then a long paragraph of something that I'd said about it, which I imagine was not positive.
Have you been Googling yourself again?
Yeah.
Drag Me to Hell at 3.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
It's not very healthy.
Of course it's healthy.
Is it?
Yeah. But how else would I know that I was on a site called 50 People More Annoying Than Mick Hucknall?
Oh, that's
true. I mean, you know, you don't want to let those things slip past.
Where were you on that list?
It didn't seem to be ordered other than alphabetically, which was kind of annoying, because I wanted to know whether I was more or less annoying than Mark Lamar, but I couldn't tell. Drag Me to Hell, good fun Sam Raimi movie, back on form, which incidentally throws forward to the Director of Public Prosecution's OPA list, which we're going to come to in a moment, because remember, Raimi cut his teeth with The Evil Dead, which was famously chased around Britain on OPA prosecution.
Night at the Museum 2 at 2.
Boring, and made only because the first one made money, and I presume there'll now be a third one.
An email from Hannah in Australia, mm-hmm. Brackets, yes, all of it. Dear Gin and Tonic, today we were lucky enough to have the day off school, so my friend and I decided to go and see something trashy and fun. We missed the first showing of I Love You Man, so we decided to go and see Night at the Museum 2. The ad's finished, and due to some bizarre quirk, Angles and Dimensions came on instead. Imagine the bewilderment of about 30 children under the age of 12 and 20 parents when, instead of Ben Stiller's friendly face, they were greeted with the sight of Ewan McGregor nailing the coffin of a dead pope. It certainly livened up an otherwise uninteresting day. Hannah, thank you, a podcaster, which is available, of course, from all usual outlets. Now, Terminator Salvation is at number one. I'll go through a bunch of these emails, mm-hmm. and then you can comment as you see fit.
Mm-hmm.
Rubbish. This is David in Gloucester. Simon, if the good doctor is not already aware, please could you share with him the information that a popular pizza emporium is currently promoting a film tie-in pizza to go with the Terminator Salvation movie. Now, I think this is quite an interesting
idea. Is this a gag or is this true?
No, this is true. Having looked at the toppings, my partner and I decided to give it a try and were amazed when the experience of eating the pizza mirrored the experience of watching the film and also of Mark's review, i.e. all the good bits were there, steak, pepperoni, ham, bacon and chicken. Or, as in Mark's review, explosions, shouting, thumping, running, explosions and shouting. But it was terribly, terribly dull when it should have been so, so good. Overall, it was stodgy, a bit hammy and not worth the cash. This is the pizza, says David. What potential horrors await us in the future as regards to food products aligning themselves to dreadful movie franchises? I think pizzas to go with movies... could well work. Toppings and, you know, whether it's spongy or thin and crispy, I think that'll work.
There used to be a diner across the road from the house which features in The Exorcist, and the diner was called the Bowie Monger. And the Bowie Monger sold a burger, which was a burger with what looked like green spew on top of it. It was actually avocado, but it was called the Exorcist Burger because it looked like somebody had ectoplasmically spewed green bomb.
Okay, well, let's try and tie it to pizzas. So pizzas movies, mayo@bbc.co.uk. John says, dear Q and not you, after hearing Mark tearing into Christian Bale last week for his silly Batman voice, I was reminded of an email that I sent around the release of Batman Begins complaining about said voice, specifically the fact that he sounded like a wrestler.
And I defended it.
Rather than agree that this was a problem, Mark gave the watertight riposte, it's Batman!
No,
and dismissed my criticism. Is Mark now prepared to add Christian Bale's silly Batman voice to the list of things that he's been wrong about? I suggest just above Neil Young and below Blue Velvet.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. The Batman voice is silly. And if I didn't fess up to it being silly, then yes, I was wrong. I think what I tried to say at the time was that they were attempting to differentiate between Batman and Bruce Wayne. But you're quite right, because I've seen Dark Knight a couple of times now. And it is silly. And the voice is a problem. No, they just don't like that. Sausages.
Ross in Hither Green in London, an area of London I didn't know of.
Hitherto.
Dear Plunkett and McLean, a long-time listener, first-time emailer, prompted to write in by one of the Doctor's recent outbursts. After Simon read a listener review of Terminator Salad Nation, Mark commented on how well the review had been written. Whilst the review was clearly concise and forthright in its views, the Doctor's praise was seemingly triggered by the fact that the review's content was virtually identical
to his own.
The point being, does Kermode only hand out such accolades to listeners whose views he agrees with? I think we know the answer. I suspect a four-page defence of Benjamin Button would never get such a claim, even if it was the finest piece of prose in years.
No. Well, I mean, it may be true that I am a total bigot when it comes to those things, but I will try not to be. I mean, I do... obviously, I understand that it's just opinions. It just happens that my ones are right.
And everyone else's
are wrong.
So let's... There's loads more stuff about Terminator. Each one, I think, giving Terminator a different... spin on the word salvation.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? And that's endlessly more interesting than
So we will do some more. We'll look at some pizzas based with movies. But first of all, we have some new releases to go.
Well, let's start with Looking for Eric, because we're now 25 past, and I've just changed my mind. I said we start with Last House, but let's do that afterwards. Because let's do Looking for Eric, because we've got a little bit of time, and we discussed this to some extent last week. It's the new movie by Ken Loach, and the story, as you probably know already, is that there is a guy whose name is Eric, who is on the skids. He's on the rebound from two marriages. He is looking after the kids of the second marriage, who are variously getting involved in criminal behaviour, and his daughter from his first marriage has a young child, so he is now a grandfather. Through babysitting arrangements, he is forced to meet his first wife, with whom he is still in love and whom he walked out on for reasons which are not entirely clear. He drinks too much. He's completely depressed. He's wound up. He finds some weed. And suddenly, he is surrounded by visions of Eric Cantona, the famous philosophizing footballer, explaining to him how it is that his life may be lived better. Here is a clip.
She hates you. Right? Now we are going somewhere.
Well, we're going nowhere. I mean, she's right. I've totally flipped. We're both grandparents.
La plus noble des vengeances, c'est de pardonner.
What?
La plus noble des vengeances, c'est de pardonner.
Look, I'm getting a bit fed up with all this, right?
Okay. I don't translate.
Oh, that's fine with me. What does it mean? Oh, come on, tell us.
No.
Oh, look, you can't just say it and then just forget about it like that.
I will not be a burden.
Oh, you're not a burden, mate. You know that. You're welcome here any time. There's no way you're a burden. Just tell us what it means.
The noblest vengeance is to forgive.
She might forgive me.
When the seagulls follow the ship.
Heavily edited sequence.
Yeah, well, can I just say a round of applause for the editors there? We, Ken Loach and Eric Cantona were on the show last week, and I think we both made clear how much we enjoyed the film, and it is very, very enjoyable. And the subject of Cantona, it's interesting because, of course, I mean, as you know, I'm not a football fan at all and have never seen a football match and knew nothing of him. I know that he's been in films before because obviously he's in Elizabeth, and then recently we saw him in a film called French Movie, in which he plays a French movie director and sort of pastiches the whole, love counselling aspect, in which he's just sitting there talking to camera saying, "Oh, l'amour is the most important thing." You know, it's turning the Cointreau advert, and you made a literally a masterpiece.
I think we're at the limit.
Cannot
of
be
your,
equaled, and the bitter virtues of oranges. And one of the things about him, which is clear, is that like all performers, he has charisma on screen. I remember Nick Rogue saying that when he cast David Bowie in The Man Who Fell to Earth, people said, "Well, he's not an actor." And he said, "Are you mad? Have you seen him on stage? That's acting. I mean, you know, when he's performing, when he's doing his songs, that's acting." In the same way as when Nick Rogue worked with Art Garfunkel and he worked with Mick Jagger, and in all of them, he saw that. And of course, there are a couple of clips in Looking for Eric in which you see Eric Cantona doing, I mean, of course, it's all new to me, but you would know it. After scoring a particularly impressive goal, he sort of stands up before the crowd with his chest out, with his collar up, which I didn't know he did, in a kind of, there is something terrible.
Yes, yeah, well, I think that was the first, I think that was, if I remember right, that was his first game back after he, because he'd been banned for a long time for a Kung Fu kick.
Yeah, I wish they'd explained the banning, because I didn't know it.
And that's the first match that he comes back, and I think that's why he reacted in that way, sort of, "Hey, I'm back, everybody."
But it's an interesting one, because he's not doing that thing which you see footballers do all the time, which is running around, you know, putting their shirts over their head and hugging each other. There's something quite graceful and dignified about the way he stands there. And it's, I mean, I can't do it. Obviously, I can't do Eric Cantona, but it is a theatrical performance. And so it's not surprising to see that on screen, he is fairly charismatic. And I think the script by Paul Haverty is very, you know, engaging and funny and warm-hearted in a way which, funnily enough, for Ken Loach, is sort of closer to the sort of fantasy wish fulfillment of something like The Full Monty, particularly in the way that the film, you know, moves towards its denouement. If there is a fault with the film, it is that there is a slight misfit between the scenes of Steve Evans, who incidentally I think is really great as the main Eric, who plays Little Eric. And I saw him recently in that film with Robert Carlyle, Summer, which is a film about somebody who's terminally ill, which we wouldn't think was a sort of comic.
That's right, Robert Carlyle came in for that.
Yeah, and I really liked him in that film. He's been around for a while, and I really liked him in that. But in this, I thought he was great, and I think it's very important that his work in the film is acknowledged, because one of the things that he does is he looks like he's just being himself. He looks like he's just being terribly natural. And it's very hard to act terribly natural. And I think one of the inclinations is to not give him the credit for that central performance, because you think, well, he's just being himself. But just being yourself as an actor is not an easy thing to do. And I think if it wasn't for his performance, if it wasn't for the way that he makes you believe in Little Eric and believe in Little Eric's visions of Big Eric, you would give the end of the film a much harder time. Because the film clearly, as it starts to deal with this gun crime subplot, as it starts to have almost a thrill narrative, in as much as he has to get his kid out of trouble with a horrible sort of, you know, gun criminal, and the way in which they resolve this, if you weren't feeling so warm natured toward the film, you might go, "Hang about a minute, that doesn't make any sense." And it's funny, because particularly for somebody like Ken Loach, who is known so much for his realist tradition, for being really gritty and really down to earth, in a way the film sort of moves almost into fantasy in the last moment. And I think that occasionally there are moments when that doesn't quite work.
It becomes The Full Monty.
It does, which is why I suggested The Full Monty about two sentences ago.
That was because I was only
busy doing something else. Yeah. Was it?
Earlier, yeah.
So I'm ripping, you're ripping me off, ripping you off.
Yeah.
Fine. Well, actually, I will accept, because after you've been in the relationship as long as we have, it is possible to completely steal other people's stories and not even recognise you're doing it.
I
think in the end, the film works. I think it was... you said last week, you know, it is genuinely a feel-good film in the way that Slumdog Millionaire genuinely wasn't. I think I forgive it for its sort of... its romantic flights of fancy, because I like Steve Evans' performance so much, and because I think that Cantona plays himself in a way which is self-deprecating and funny. I think Ken Loach is a proper filmmaker, and particularly at a time when we're seeing, you know, Transformers 2 is coming up. I know you're looking forward to seeing that, and
Well, yes. I am seeing it on Monday morning.
I wonder whether it'll be robots hitting each other. I don't know. I mean, who knows? Who can tell? Who can tell? And although I don't think it's perfect, I think there's so much about it that makes you feel good that the things that are wrong with it don't matter. But I do want to say that Steve Evans' performance, I think, is really, really key to what's good about it.
Pizzas in films, Mick and Chorley, A Wonderful Life. Deep pan, crisp and even.
Oh, that's good.
And Paul Adnett in London, Dear Slap and Tickle, I see the Terminator pizza posters every day on my way home from work, and they've missed a trick, I think. Shouldn't it be the Terminator salivation pizza, which is an interesting point? But then he says, I would recommend the Meat Feast the Parents 12-inch special.
Do you think that if you said, if you advertised a pizza with the tagline, I'll be back, it would suggest that perhaps it wasn't up to snuff?
I think it probably would, actually. We'll continue that. And what's next? What's the...
Let's do Last House on the Left next.
OK, and then The Hangover?
Yeah, okay. We're going to do The Hangover.
Don't forget the podcast is available. You can go to the Five Live website. And if you want to enhance the experience even more, perhaps now would be a good point to say there's a little kind of a TV experiment which we're undergoing next Sunday.
Sunday. It's like the Quatermass experiment, but with you and me.
That's right. And we're filming
the Quatermass experiment.
It's sort of like a film club idea.
It is.
Which is why it's been called...
Film Club.
Yeah. Anyway, if you'd like to be in the audience, we're going to be filming this in London, and it's going to be Sunday week.
Yes.
The way you can find out more, as it's part of the Culture Show thing,
is
to send an email to culture.show@bbc.co.uk.
Yes.
Is that the way it works?
I assume so. You're the technical person on this.
Something like that. It's not a vast crowd of people. It's like 80 or 100 people.
We want a small, well-selected audience who will sit there whilst you and I talk about a few films that are classic, not new releases, classics, and discuss whether or not they are indeed cult examples of their genre.
Yeah, so if you fancy that, obviously there's no pay. And we're not
or gonna, transport,
we're not
or hospitality, or sympathy, or nothing.
Nothing at all. You just get to stand there
and
look interested. And we will have a whip round for hard-up BBC presenters. But apart from that, that's all that's actually going to be expected.
You're on your own, essentially.
Send us an email to culture.show@bbc.co.uk and they will, you know, basically it's over to them.
Exactly.
And not us.
Exactly.
Don't email us here.
And while we're doing hello to everyone I know, can I just
haven't done that. We should do that then.
What?
Say hello.
Yes, hello to Jason Isaacs.
Yes, hello, Jason Isaacs. Hello.
Just did Al Jolson.
Do the whole waving routine. Hello to Stephen Fry. I don't suppose he's going to be watching.
No.
Hello to all members of Fairport Convention.
Looking forward to Cropperty.
And who else is
it? I want to say hello to, I have to do this.
Oh, David Morrissey. Hi, David Morrissey.
Rob, Phil, Andrew and Richard, who are mates of
Michael
mine.
Michael Sheen, how are you doing?
Wave to Rob, Phil, Andrew and Richard, who are mates of mine, who are halfway up Mont Blanc at the moment in
they're
a
not,
tent.
They're not following,
well, apparently
they?
It's very cold and they are wearing gloves on their feet. And I say hello to them simply
instead
because...
Instead of shoes.
No, they're having a go at doing this for the second time. The first time they asked me if I would go with them and I foolishly at the beginning said, yeah, and then I went, no... So now, this is now the second time that I'm not with them. But I'm with them in spirit, if not in fat
I'm
physicality.
I'm sure that's a great comfort for them.
I'm sure it is.
Last House on the Left. This will be a remake then.
Yes. OK, now where to start with Last House on the Left? Well, let's start with the original. Back in the early 1970s, Last House on the Left was made by Wes Craven and Sean Cunningham. Wes Craven, because famously went on to make the Nightmare on Elm Street films and to become a very, very successful horror filmmaker, made the Scream series. Sean Cunningham, meanwhile, went on to make Friday the 13th. Last House on the Left was a very, very nasty, low-budget, unpleasant film that was essentially inspired by two things. One of them was the Ingmar Bergman film, The Virgin Spring. The second was TV footage of the Vietnam War. It was a sleazy exploitation movie that began life as a really sleazy grindhouse movie and kind of turned during its process into something else. The story is about two young girls who are kidnapped and raped and killed, and then the people who do the appalling crime then end up at the house of the parents of one of the girls, and retribution happens. And it's a very grim movie, and it's basically about the way that violence begets violence on one level. It is also, it is undoubtedly true, it was a film about making money. It was a classically an exploitation movie, but it had extraordinary sort of art house elements to it. When it first played in America, some people hated it so much that they broke into the projection box and cut the film up to stop it being projected. Now, it became a bête noir of the censors. It was involved in the video nasties list. It was one of the DPP's list of titles that, you know, were not to be shown. It was banned here for a very long time, and a very short story about it. A few years ago, They were trying to get it. It's now available uncut, but a few years ago they were trying to get it through uncut, and it wasn't. I was arguing that it ought to be allowed to be shown uncut because although it's a grim and a really nasty film, it was a historical artifact. And I wrote for there was the BBFC were considering the case, and I wrote what was considered to be an academic defence of the film, saying, you know, no matter what you think about it, it has status as a piece of history. It's a very important film in the evolution of American horror. And when we went into the hearing, the BBFC wanted to cut it by 16 seconds, and when we came out of the hearing after hearing my evidence, they doubled the cuts up to 32 seconds because my
great advocate you
exactly
are.
I
get
actually
Mark on your side and lose twice.
Anybody want to be defended by me, believe me, I will send you down for life. So anyway, now the film has been remade in the, as is now traditional, taking every film that was made from the 1970s and remaking it in a slightly more stylish fashion. It's still got the involvement of Cunningham and Wes Craven, but it's been produced in a much slicker, much more sort of modern-looking package. The story, however, is essentially the same. It essentially ends up with parents faced with people who have committed a horrendous crime, which is slightly different in this version, and facing the prospect that they will become as violent as the people who are with them. Here's a clip.
We are going to get her to a hospital, okay? We are going to do this.
They're still here. What if they come over here?
I know. You're right. Which means we're going to be ready for anything. We have to be ready to do anything. You hear me?
We don't have a car. I mean, the nearest house is 6 miles from here. How we...
By land. 6 miles by land. Okay, we're going to do this. You with me? We're going to do it.
Now, the thing that I have to say is this. The original film was horrible and uneven and raggedy and disreputable and very, very important because of when it happened and because of what it was about. Wes Craven famously walked out of the first screening of Reservoir Dogs when it played at the Sitges Film Festival. And Quentin Tarantino said, I don't believe the guy who made Last House on the Left just walked out of my film. And I asked Craven about it. He said, well, the problem was that I felt that Last House was about something. It was about the way in which violence was being sold around the time of the Vietnam War, and it was about genre movies. When he watched Reservoir Dogs, he thought that the violence was just there for the sake of it. In the case of the remake, it is clearly a better made film than the original, in that it is better directed, it is better shot, they've ironed out some of the plot problems, because the plot in the original is very, very raggedy, although, as I said, it's inspired by the Bergman story. And they've done some sort of moving around of certain set pieces in order to just make it rather more smooth. And there's no denying the efficiency with which it is done. However, the question that I have is this. Why would you remake Last House on the Left in the first place? The obvious reason is clearly money. We are now in a period in which what you do with horror is you remake it. So as I said, all the Texas Chainsaw movies have all been sort of variously remade. We've seen remakes of all the sort of the 70s slashers. You know, recently My Bloody Valentine, which is an 80s slasher, it was in cinemas. It's just a matter of working through the back catalogue. The problem with the new Last House is that although it's put together solidly, and although in many ways it's less sleazy and less reprehensible than the original, in fact, in one key plot point, it is less obnoxious than the original, in that it sort of allows a certain element of salvation. The problem is this. The original is so horrible and so wretched and so nasty and so tough and so much a film which just says, can a movie ever go too far? And the question is, actually, you know what? Maybe it can. When you take the edges of it off, when you make it into a more efficient machine, when you solve the plot problems, when you put the thing together more convincingly, you're sort of left with, yeah, okay, but what's the point? And a classic example is, in the original film, there are these bizarre slapstick interludes because Craven and Cunningham, who didn't really know what they were doing, thought, you know, after all this violence and horror, we ought to have some slapstick bits with some people in an overloaded truck and some chickens. Now, when you go back and look at Last House now, those bits are so wrong and so incongruous. Everything about them is wrong. And yet somehow when you solve those problems, you're just left with something which is sleek and efficient. And also, the other thing is that in the original film, the message was this: violence begets violence and it's all horrible. And somehow in the remake, the message has transmuted slightly into there can be a salvation in violence. And I've got to say that for me, I mean, nobody in their right mind would say that watching Last House on the Left was an enjoyable experience. And there's a moment at the end of the remake of Last House on the Left, which is a very, very silly moment with a microwave oven, which is very, very silly and clearly should have hit the cutting room floor. But since it's not a fun story, I mean, all the stuff that's meant to be horrible is horrible. But I just wonder whether, to me, it's rather like, you know, the time and the place of the original was so much a part of why it was important. When you decontextualise it and turn it into something else, what you do is take away the meaning of it. In the end, Last House wasn't the important thing. It was the time that it happened. And now we just have a nuts of... I mean, I can't say that I would advise anybody. So it's not like I'm going to say, well, don't go and see the original. Go and get the original on DVD, because it's such an unpleasant watch, but it's an important unpleasant watch. And what the remake is...
I don't want to watch that, though.
No, I know you don't. And I'm
so I don't as watch I said, something that's important.
But, no, I'm not... But the thing is, the remake, I don't think even is important. That's not to say it's badly made. I think it's well made, and I think they've done a decent job of it, but I just think it's pointless.
Dear Major Kong and Dr. Strangelove, this is Simon in Colchester. Two things to mention. Firstly, your hello list. Surely there's an obvious omission. Should you be saying hello to Lionel Richie?
Lionel Richie, why?
That's what he says.
Hello. Is that because he says hello?
Almost certainly.
I see. No,
I don't think so either. On a more serious point, on the DPP band list, the part which he then prints out in its entirety.
It's the long version that he prints out there, the big 60.
Apart from Last House on the Lift, what five films...
Last House on the Lift? This,
yes.
which
five would the good doctor recommend as essential viewing? So it's the entire list, which has got all kinds of things. I'm particularly intrigued by... Twitch of the Death Nerve,
yeah.
Killer Nun,
yeah.
Which looks quite fun. And then a series, Don't Go in the House, Don't Go in the Woods, and then Don't Go near the Park.
Yes, and Don't Go down to the woods
There's
today. Lots of don'ts, yes. I mean, I would say of the DPP list, the ones that were essential viewing, Driller Killer, obviously, because it's the Abel Ferrara film that was kind of... It's interesting because it's got the Johnny Coca-Cola stuff in it, which is quite good, and it's got Abel Ferrara in it. Evil Dead, of course, which is the great Sam Raimi movie, which should never have been on that list in the first place. Last House on the Left, just for historical, you know, completeness. Cannibal Holocaust always comes up. The problem with Cannibal Holocaust is it features genuine and completely unforgivable animal cruelty. And so I'm one of those people who actually thinks that the BBFC cut version of Cannibal Holocaust is more acceptable than the uncut version. But if we didn't have Cannibal Holocaust, you wouldn't have Blair Witch Project. But the real outstanding widget in that list is The Witch Who Came from the Sea, which, as Kim Newman said famously, God bless the director of public prosecutions, because if he hadn't put that on that list, none of us would ever have heard of it. And it's a really, really strange movie in the manner of something like Hard Candy. I mean, it's an anti-date movie, and I would never have seen it if the DPP hadn't banned it.
Should we do Hangover next?
Yes.
The whole show from Edinburgh next week, the film festival there, where Ian Hart's going to be one of our...
Yeah, I love Ian Hart.
Alan Cumming?
I was once asked to describe my perfect British film, and I said, directed by Ken Russell and starring Ian Hart.
Okay, that's really good. Anyway, and other surprise guests, apparently...
or not.
Still got a chance of that bloke
I told you about. Apparently.
Not.
Could be.
I can't even, you know, can we move on? Because
so
I'll
it's in Radio Vision, and you're going to be able to press the red button on your television. It's going to be
extraordinary.
Pizza tie-ins. This is because of the Terminator Salvation. Sandy Wright in South East London. You're going to, even you will get this pizza. The film, Spring, Summer, Autumn, Winter and Spring.
Mm-hmm.
What's the pizza?
For five seasons.
Yeah, that'll do. Sandy Wright in South London, Marley and Me, promoted with a four-cheese pizza with optional extra cheese.
Very good.
And Andy for the Steve Martin Pink Panther remakes, a Neapolitan pizza, not much depth, very cheesy and the distinct smell of fish. And Andrew in South London, most of Fellini's films sound like pizza toppings anyway. A Dolce Vita, 8.5, Amicord, Vitelloni, and so on. Which is a fair point.
Very good.
Right, it's time for The Hangover.
Yeah.
Heather Graham and Ed Helm, who were on the programme briefly earlier on in the week.
Were they good?
Well, it was quite a fun conversation with them, but it got a bit shashy on the old interview line.
Shashy?
Shashy.
What
does
that
there
mean?
Was interference between here and their luxury hotel, which meant that we had to curtail the entertainment.
Well, the story is...
What is the story?
There's a bunch of... Well, you know this anyway. There's a bunch of blokes. One of them's getting married. The other one say, let's go to Las Vegas for a weekend. Now, let me say that any film that involves going to Las Vegas that isn't either Leaving Las Vegas or Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas automatically kind of starts to lose my sympathy, because I have been to Las Vegas and it is the end of the world.
I agree with you on that.
And so they decide to go to Las Vegas for a great time, and they go with the bride's brother, and then they go to the hotel, they check into the hotel, they wake up the next morning, and they can't remember anything. There is a tiger in the bathroom, there is a baby in the cupboard, and then they have to spend the rest of the movie finding out what it was that they did on the night. It's that thing about I've forgotten what it is that I was drinking to forget. And they have to therefore... So basically, it's Dude, Where's My Wedding? Although apparently we're not supposed to notice that. Anyway, at one point in their travels, they come back to their hotel room to find Mike Tyson, yes, Mike Tyson, in their hotel asking for his tiger back. And because we're a sports network... Here's the bit with Mike Tyson.
Mike Tyson? This is my favorite part coming up right now. I can feel it coming in the air tonight. Of course, my guy. Oh, Lord. But I've been waiting for this moment. Oh, my life. One more time, guys. Oh, Lord. Oh, oh. Why did you do that?
Mr. Tyson would like to know, why is this tiger in your bathroom?
There was talk for a while that they were going to make a sequel to Dude, Where's My Car called Seriously, Dude, Where's My Car, which is quite a funny title. The problem that I have with the wedding, and I sat in a screening when there was much laughter. People did, you know, guffaw. Chuckle, you know.
There were lots of comments when Heather Graham and Ed Helm were on, and I put it on Twitter, and loads of people saying, actually, I was expecting it to be a bit rubbish, but actually, I laughed more than I was expecting.
I wanted to laugh much, much more than I did. I laughed twice, and generally, my feeling about it was that I just kind of don't care. Because the problem is this, in order to find comedies funny, you have to have some sort of engagement with the characters. You have to find that in some way their predicament is, you know, sympathetic. Or they have to be just so repulsive that their repulsiveness is funny. The thing with this is it's just nothing. It's just, oh, we've got to find out what we did. Heather Graham's a stripper. There's a surprise. Very, very underwritten role. She does her very best with it, but there's really nothing. I sit there watching Heather Graham thinking, you were so great in Boogie Nights. What happened? And obviously what happened is that there just aren't many great parts. And there's a breastfeeding joke, which I kind of winced at because I find that stuff kind of just, you know, chauvinistically boring. And we're meant to find these guys engaging, and I don't find them engaging. And then the scale of the things that happen just gets bigger and bigger. They got Mike Tyson's tiger in the bathroom. There's actually a baby that's been lost. They steal a police car, and And I start worrying about things like, well, the time scale doesn't work. It's meant to be 24 hours, but they kind of got from there to there in 6 hours, and it must be 10 o'clock by now. And there's a sort of underlying thread of just blokey lariness that apparently everyone else in the screening room found really funny. Now, I can't deny this. In the screening that I saw, people of both genders were laughing. Not me. I just thought, oh, do we have to do this all over again? Do we have to do the story about the four blokes going on in Las Vegas and strippers and the thing and the marriage and the chapel?
That's a new voice. I haven't heard that voice before.
That's me. I'm like Mike Yarwood, and now this is me. Oh, do we really have to do it all over again? I was watching thinking, I want to laugh. I want to be Revenge of the Nerds. I want to, and I start thinking about, you know, have I filled out my tax returns? Did I leave the electricity on? But I did. That's it, Simon. Oh, I know. I do become that person. I'm sorry. It may be me, or it may be that the film isn't half as funny as everybody who was laughing likes to think.
Noah in New Jersey. Dear Arthur and Patsy, saw Hangover in spite of myself, thanks to all the glowing reviews from the American press. What were they thinking?
Oh, good.
What's so funny about a bunch of one-dimensional adults acting like adolescent nitwits?
Yep.
If I had known what I was getting into, I would have saved my money and rewatched Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Hey, there we are.
An infinitely smart... He just knows how to get his email ready.
He does. Good for
smarter
him.
And funnier film that sees Las Vegas for the cesspool it really
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
Please tell the good doctor... Please tell me the good doctor won't give it the pass, my fellow Americans.
No, and I'm amazed by, you know, people are saying, oh, well, despite myself, I laughed. And I can't lie, I didn't.
Stuart in Littlehampton.
Went and saw The Hangover last night after the trailer. An early review suggested it might actually rise above the recent wave of a style bromance comedies, of which I generally have no interest. Despite the hype, I'm positive that it will fail the Doctor's comedy acid test of five laughs. At best, I chuckled several times during the opening 20 minutes, by which time the concept had totally run flat, and I came to the depressing realisation that I was not going to laugh again for the remainder of the film, which proved to be the case. I'm sure the writers must have done their fair share of drinking during the process of writing the movie, as I can imagine a scenario where scenes like Mike Tyson singing Mike Tyson. Phil Collins might have seemed vaguely amusing while drunk. A real hangover, though, is meant to remind you what seemed like a laugh the night before is often quite the opposite the next morning. It's just a shame they didn't suffer such a hangover themselves.
I would like to remind everybody, incidentally, anyone who is in any doubts about the efficacy of the having the Mike Tyson cameo, of the film that was made recently, the documentary film. Did you see it, Tyson?
No, I did not.
Documentary.
It was when I was off.
Yeah, and it was... Well, it's an interesting thing because it's out of his own mouth, is he condemned? I mean, his attitude towards women is positively Neanderthal, and just... What's staggering about it is that you think, I can't believe somebody's actually saying those words out loud in the real world rather than just thinking them in their head and them getting censored before they get to your mouth. You know, you just don't say some of the things that he says. I mean, and people say, oh, well, he's being honest. Well, yeah, but that's not an excuse. And I did think, although The Hangover isn't anything like as misogynist as perhaps it could have been, it is still boringly blokey in that, oh, aren't these guys drinking beer and doing stuff with strippers? Aren't they really interesting? No, they're not interesting. They're just... Did you ever hang out with them? Did you ever go to a bachelor party? Have you ever been to a bachelor party?
Well, is that the same as a stag night?
Yeah, that's what it is. A stag night. Have you ever been to a stag night?
Well, yeah, I've been to a few, but they were...
Have you?
Not the way they're portrayed in movies. It's just going down to the pub and having a meal afterwards.
Do you want to know what I did for my stag night?
Not really, no.
Shall I tell you?
Oh, go on.
I will do. Here's what I did for my stag night. I took myself to a cinema in London to watch the 70mm print of The Exorcist and went home and had an early night. And you know what? One of the best nights of my life. Loved it. Great. All
what,
that I
what
did,
a weirdo.
Going out on... No,
what?
Sorry, on the way. Oh, with my lads. I mean, just hell on earth.
Did you not think to invite some friends?
No, why?
Have a meal afterwards?
No.
To enjoy their company?
No.
Excuse for a party?
I don't like parties. I don't like parties, and I don't like people, and I don't like hangovers. Or that hangover in particular.
Thanks very much indeed for listening.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.